Support for this podcast and the following message come from Wise, the app that makes managing your money in different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money internationally at the mid-market exchange rate. No guesswork and no hidden fees. Learn more about how Wise could work for you at wise.com.
Today on State of the World, to no one's surprise, Vladimir Putin is reelected. Thanks for listening to State of the World from NPR. We bring you the day's most vital international stories up close where they're happening. It's Monday, March 18th. I'm Greg Dixon. In a few minutes, the legacy of a young American activist who died in Gaza over 20 years ago. But first, Russian President Vladimir Putin has won a fifth term in office, setting a record. This is a result that surprised absolutely no one. The government used both intimidation and the offer of prizes, including new homes, to get the election result it wanted. Putin is reported to have received 87% of the vote. The U.S. government said the election was neither free nor fair. NPR's Charles Maines is in Moscow. He spoke to Scott Detrow on Sunday, the final day of voting, and described the mood.
Well, you know, this election at times had an atmosphere of a carnival. You know, you noted giving out big prizes like apartments, there were cars, iPhones, all to lure in voters. And it seemed part of a wider Kremlin strategy to secure not only this huge victory for Vladimir Putin, but also a historic turnout. It's to show the country is united behind the president after more than 2 years of war, of course, in Ukraine. But I must say that I met several Putin supporters this weekend who still look backwards. You know, they're focused on how Putin, in their view, rescued the country from the chaos and humiliation of the post-Soviet 90s. Let's listen.
Воздух. Это слово. А жизнь.
So this is someone named Vladimir, a pensioner, was a voter, saying that words of politicians are just empty air, but that Putin had made life actually better for Russians. In fact, he says that Putin was a man of deeds who raised the country from its knees.
And despite statements like that and despite the turnout and the numbers that we're seeing, there were moments of dissent. Some of the moments of dissent were a little bit bizarre. Tell us about them.
Yeah, you know, dozens of Russians were arrested for protests that included setting voting booths on fire, pouring liquid dye into ballot boxes, all in apparent frustration over an election that offered no real choice. You know, keep in mind Putin's three competitors here were all from his rubber-stamped parliament and largely supported Putin's policies. Meanwhile, openly anti-war candidates were banned from the ballot over registration problems. Vote rigging was also a concern, not least because of an expansion of electronic voting. And one would-be voter I met, Sergei, who works in the security business, said he was sitting out the election because he thought the whole thing was rigged. In fact, he insisted that if there was an honest vote, the results would basically be reversed. Mm-hmm.
Реально, 70% населения против этой войны.
So here Sergei says, in reality, 75% of Russians are against this war and against this president who is leading the country to ruin.
And let's just put the protests that we did see in context, because there were demonstrations against Putin by Russians and other people outside of Russian embassies and other countries. But, I mean, it must be really hard to make a show in Russia itself, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is a highly repressive environment now. Most of the opposition is either in jail or worse. Of course, last month, the opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, died in a remote Arctic prison colony under still mysterious circumstances. We don't know the whole story. Navalny's widow, Yulia Navalnaya, called on her husband's supporters, in fact, to act on his last known political wish by swarming polling stations at noon on Sunday and providing a symbolic contrast to what she argues and also, you know, Navalny's allies say is Putin's hollow mandate. And so today I watched as some 200 Russians suddenly appeared at the stroke of noon at a voting precinct in Moscow, even if talking to people about it could feel like having a conversation in code.
Да, мы специально пришли в конкретное время, 12 часов.
This is Anton, a young professional, who told me he showed up at 12 because that was his family's tradition for elections, with a bit of a wink. Because if it's true, a lot of other people were observing it. You know, lines formed at polling stations in Moscow and other big cities across Russia today, all at noon. But of course, nothing like the huge crowds we saw outside Russian embassies in Asia, Europe, and elsewhere.
Interesting way to protest in a way that you can in that environment. So we have the outcome. What happens next?
It's expected that Putin will seize on these election results to argue that Russians have united behind the war effort. And yet he may have to deal with a sense of war fatigue that seems to be setting in. You know, I think it's no accident that a recent poll found 75% of Russians would support ending the war tomorrow.
It's NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Last weekend marked 21 years since a young American woman was killed in Gaza. She was trying to stop the Israeli demolition of homes there. And with the current war in Gaza now in its sixth month, people are revisiting her story. NPR's Jane Arraf in Amman looks at her legacy.
Rachel Corey was a college student from Olympia, Washington, 23 years old. In March 2003, when she talked to Middle East Broadcasting Network, she was on the edge of the Gaza city of Rafah, surrounded by demolished houses.
The Israeli military bulldozed the two largest water wells, destroying over half of Rafah's water supply. Every few days, if not every day, houses are demolished here.
Corey had gone to Gaza to join nonviolent protests against the destruction. Israel said at the time it was clearing the area of places militants could hide. 2 days after she gave the interview, she was crushed by an armored Israeli bulldozer about to demolish the home where she was staying, as described here by CNN.
A 23-year-old American activist stands in front of an Israeli bulldozer in Gaza, March 16, 2003. The bulldozer drives over her, crushing her to death.
An Israeli army investigation concluded the soldiers in the bulldozer's armored cab hadn't seen or heard Corey, who was wearing a fluorescent orange jacket and speaking through a megaphone. Her parents, Cindy and Craig Corey, spent years pursuing the case in Israel and the U.S. They never succeeded in holding anyone accountable for their daughter's death. They say it's possible her death was an accident, but there has never been an investigation independent of the Israeli military. They've worked for two decades to make sure she didn't die in vain.
If people had told me before Rachel was killed that something like this would happen and that somehow we'd find a way to carry on, I would have said, no, you're wrong. I won't draw another breath.
That's Cindy Corey, her mother. She and Rachel's father, Craig Corey, have traveled to Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel several times since Rachel was killed.
After a little while, you realize we've met many Palestinians and Israelis that feel the same way, have suffered the same sort of loss, and want no one else to suffer that.
Corey was with an activist group, the International Solidarity Movement. After she died, her parents established a foundation in her name. There's a Rachel Corey Street in Ramallah in the West Bank, soccer tournaments, and a children's center in Rafah named after her. The vessel, MV Rachel Corey, in 2010 set out to disrupt Israel's sea blockade of Gaza. In the Arab world, people name their daughters after her. But it's her words that have traveled the furthest. In a book and a play based on her journals called My Name is Rachel Corey, and in emails home, including this one, read by poet Maya Angelou.
What if our aloneness isn't a tragedy? What if our aloneness is that which allows us to speak the truth without being afraid?
At age 10, Corey wrote a statement about world hunger and read it at a press conference in the Washington State Capitol.
We have got to understand that people in third world countries think and care and smile and cry just like us. We have got to understand that they dream our dreams and we dream theirs.
2 decades after she was killed, Israel is still demolishing homes. The World Bank estimates Israel has destroyed 45% of all homes in Gaza since Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th. Rachel Corey's father, a Vietnam veteran, said he learned from his young daughter.
Some of that just continually goes in my mind, talking about the others. They are us. We are them. They dream our dream. We dream theirs. But that, to me, is totally true. And it needs to be repeated.
Corey's parents say her legacy is the community of people who believe we are all interconnected, that her life and death inspired. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Amman, Jordan.
That's the State of the World from NPR. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.
On Wildcard, the new podcast from NPR, you'll hear people like comedian Jenny Slate reflect on their lives.
What is something you think about very differently today than you did 10 years ago?
Dressing, like not salad dressing. I've always loved it and I'll never stop. Dressing my body.
That's all part of the new game show Wildcard, only from NPR. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing. Visit your local REI Co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways to opt outside. Support for NPR and the following message come from SAP Concur, a leading brand for integrated travel expense and invoice management solutions. With SAP Concur solutions, you'll be ready to take on whatever the market throws at you next. Learn more at concur.com.